Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Verde Gallery, currently featuring Landscapes, an exhibition of paintings by David Stratton, also featuring a bluegrass jam every Tuesday at 7 p.m. Verde Gallery, a fine art gallery, cafe, and newsroom located at 17 East Taylor in downtown Champaign, on the web at verdant-systems.com. Be inspired. Programs on WILL are made possible in part by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone roundtables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada.
It's 106. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Celeste Quinn is away today. I'm Tom Rogers, and we bring you an archive interview today. And because this will be a tape program for the entire hour, we are not taking phone calls.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, we'll examine this question. How is justice pursued in a time of war? We'll look back at the largest army court-martial of World War II. It involved the lynching of an Italian POW in U.S. custody in Seattle. The year was 1944. Three African-American soldiers were charged with murder. 40 other black soldiers were charged with rioting. The lead prosecutor was Leon Jaworski, best known as the Watergate special prosecutor who forced the Nixon White House to turn over Nixon's Oval Office tapes. Our guest today is journalist Jack Hammond. He is the author of On American Soil, How Justice Became a Casualty of World War II. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Jack Hammond has been a news reporter, network correspondent, and documentary producer. Most recently, he was Seattle bureau chief for the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. On American Soil, How Justice Became a Casualty of World War II is his first book. The publisher is Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. Jack Hammond, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you, Celeste. Glad to be here.
Would you tell our listeners the story of how you began working this story?
I began my journalism career, like most reporters, as a daily assignment reporter. And that simply means that the assignment editor gives you whatever's on the list. And that day in 1986, I was asked to go to a big city park here in Seattle where they were discussing whether to expand a sewage treatment plant. It was a process kind of story, somewhat boring, and one of the employees at the park noticed that I was a little distracted, and she said, you know, it's too bad because there's an awful lot of interesting things here at this park. And I said, okay, what? And she said, well, you know, this used to be a very large army fort for decades before it became a park. And here on the in the old part of the fort, they have this wonderful little military graveyard that looks like just about any other military graveyard, in that the headstones are all uniform and they're all in lines, except that over to one side is this large, very striking headstone shaped in the form of a Roman column, designed, it appeared, to make it look as if the top had been broken off. And at the base, she said, there were words that she thought might be Latin or Greek or something. I went running over there to see it. Turned out the words were in Italian, and it was easy to see that the person in that headstone had died on August 14th, 1944. This is the days before the internet, and I went to the Seattle Public Library a few days later to the archives and began looking at the newspapers of that era, and could not find anything on August 14th, 15th, 16th. But all of a sudden, there were huge headlines in all of the newspapers, first just in Seattle and then all across the United States and even the world, about this riot that had occurred at Fort Lawton, resulting in the death of an Italian prisoner of war, and the astonishing charge that it was a lynching that had killed that Italian, and that the suspects were all African American. And that began what to me was a series of events that led to the book, but it also started with a oh my gosh moment. I can't believe this. How could this be?
Yeah. And eventually, over time, you worked the story while you were I had a little time from doing sewage stories. You worked the story, and then you brought it to television, and
yes.
that product, you say, mostly a lie, albeit not an intentional lie. How significantly different was the story you told from that of what really happened?
Well, I, in 1986, made the mistake that I think a lot of journalists and, frankly, historians make, and that is I relied too heavily, back then almost exclusively, on secondary sources. I wrote about what I found that reporters had written in the 1940s, and, of course, they were limited by all sorts of constraints. The Army was able legally to censor much of what they could report. They were, in most cases, simply watching what the lawyers, particularly Prosecutor Leon Jaworski, wanted them to see and hear. And the story really that I did back then was that there had been a race riot, that black soldiers had been exceedingly upset about the presence and alleged favorable treatment of these Italian prisoners of war relative to their treatment. And that I think the implication of my story, as with most, was that it appeared justice was a little muddy, but probably justice was done. And that really is very, very different than what I was able to discover when I revisited this 15 years later in 2001 and decided to pursue it full time. And by using, instead of secondary sources, using in fact the primary sources of this wealth of material that we were able to discover after a lot of work, of what the Army actually knew about the case. And clearly it was two things. Number one, it was not a race riot that led up to this lynching. And number two, none of the black soldiers killed that Italian.
Yeah. Well, we'll ferret out some of what happened as we go on here this afternoon. But I was curious about when you and your wife Leslie began sifting through the primary documents, You found out that they had only been recently declassified. Why had the documents been classified, and why for such a long period of time?
Well, I don't usually, and in this case I also don't, really believe much in conspiracy or conspiracy theories unless there's really strong evidence. And I don't think there was a conspiracy in this case. Here's what I understand was the way things happened at the end of World War II. Almost 10 million men and women served in the armed forces in World War II. And by war's end, there were still many, many millions. And there was a huge effort to get back to normalcy, to get people out of uniform and back into the normal daily life. And what that meant was is that literally tens of millions of documents that were from everything from trivial to highest top secret were very, very quickly assembled, boxed, put into rooms, then moved to warehouses. And in many cases, it was sometimes months or years later that someone in a clerical position would look at some of this material, not really know what it was or wasn't, and make a decision whether to stamp it top secret, classified, or whatever, and then put it away. And from all of the work that we did, we think that the record, and when I say the primary documents that we found, we always had the trial record, but we never had, until we eventually found it, the actual thousands of pages of the Army's own investigation of this case that had been conducted by a general. And I don't have any evidence that someone intentionally wanted to hide anything. I think simply it got caught up in just the bureaucracy of trying to document and store all of these records, and we just had to be as persistent as we ended up being for literally months before we found it.
Hmm. Well, let's go back to August of 1944, specifically August 15th, and it is pre-dawn hours, and a couple of men are looking for men. A couple of military police are looking for men who had not returned to their barracks at Fort Lawton, Washington, following a battle the night before between African-American troops and Italian prisoners of war held there. What did they find?
One of the two. There was a white soldier who's an MP and a black soldier who was with him, who had not known each other until that evening, had never met. And the white MP somehow managed in the pitch dark before dawn to look up at the base of a large, steep bluff that goes down into Elliott Bay here in Seattle and see what he thought was the form of a human. And as he approached, the two of them discovered that this Italian had was hanging from a noose that had been suspended from a obstacle course. The obstacle course had two cables suspended between a couple of trees. This had been tied to that cable, and he was dead. The fight that you talk about the night before really is the crux of a lot of this. The reporting had always been, back in 1944, and to the extent anyone ever mentioned this, largest and longest Army court-martial ever, always said that the blacks had resented the white, the Italian soldiers. The first thing to know is that in 1944, as throughout American history up until that point, the Army was segregated. Mm-hmm. And black soldiers were not specifically allowed to be quartered or do many other things with white soldiers. And at this particular fort, they took it one step further. Not only were the black soldiers put in this relatively isolated part of the fort, but they decided to put the Italian prisoners right next to them, literally within, you know, a very short couple of feet. And what we discovered was that the Army knew, although it was not clearly put into the trial as much as it could have been, that this whole thing was simply precipitated by one or two black soldiers who had become inebriated and one or two Italian soldiers who had also been drinking. And when one of each group confronted each other when they were out after curfew, a fist fight ensued. The black soldier lost the fight, which is to say he was knocked out and bleeding. And within a very short period, other African-American soldiers were alerted, awakened, and told by their colleagues and others that they had been attacked by the Italians. And these were soldiers, of course. And as it turns out, even further, they were scheduled to be shipped overseas to New Guinea the very next day. And so they responded as they were trained to, which is, we've been attacked. It's these Italians who are our enemies. Let's go get them. Mm-hmm. And that's what started it.
Yeah. And what happened? What do you think happened to the Italian prisoner of war who was found hanged? Guglielmo.
His name is Guglielmo Olivotto, 33 years old, yeah. An unwilling soldier, as so many of these poor soldiers were who were part of the Italian army. He had grown up quite poor in a northern part of Italy, not far from Venice. And in the first part of the 19th century, he had left to go to France to find work. But eventually, once France was invaded by Hitler, he was conscripted unwillingly back into Italy and to Mussolini's army. And like so many soldiers at the time, they were sent to North Africa. And then, of course, North Africa was where the Allies made their first offensive push, Patton, Montgomery famously, going against Rommel for the Nazis. And eventually the Allies prevailed, and 250,000 German and Italian soldiers were captured on 1 week in Cape Bon. Guglielmo Olivotto was part of that group. And he, like really, as it turns out, a fortunate few of the Italians, instead of being sent to Britain or South Africa or India, where a lot of prisoners were, he had the good fortune initially to be sent to the United States, where the U.S. had made a determined effort to treat its prisoners of war with compassion, with dignity, all because of the then brand new requirements of the Geneva Convention. Once the Italian government surrendered in 1943, Italy was still occupied in large part by German soldiers. War was still going on, and prisoners like Olivotto were still considered prisoners until their homeland was freed, but they were given the opportunity to declare their allegiance to the Allies, be issued American-style uniforms, and actually work on bases under guard for wages. So Olivotto was part of that group. You ask what I think really happened on mm-hmm. that day. As it turns out, despite the reporting, the evidence that the Army itself disclosed quite dramatically was that people across the U.S., there were stories in the New York Times, in the L.A. Times, in the Chicago papers, people across the United States who were themselves veterans or who had veterans of the North African campaign, in many cases bitterly resented this quasi-prisoner status that the Italians were given. They were still viewed as enemies by many people, and they were simply upset as they could be that these now former enemies or recent enemies were walking around in uniforms and were getting paid. They wanted them locked up, basically. So, as it turns out, that was primarily a feeling that was shared by white Americans, because white Americans were the ones who fought in North Africa. There were only a very few African Americans. At Fort Lawton, where all these events took place, there was a certain group of white soldiers who were themselves very upset about the presence of the Italians. And for day after day, there were these conflicts between white soldiers and the blacks. And what we were able to show in the book is that it was the handiwork of a couple of those white soldiers who could have stopped this this riot from building, where the black soldiers were trying to get revenge against the Italians, and chose very specifically not to. And further, all the evidence points to the fact that they, one man in particular, were able to himself lynch this Italian and make it look as if the blacks had done it. And, you know, that's what we think really happened. I think that's where the evidence points. It's something that the Army had all the evidence for at the time of the trial, but none of that was introduced at trial.
Why not?
Well, there are a couple of things. First of all, the largest picture of all is this. The lynching took place in August of 1944. 2 months earlier in June was D-Day, the invasion of Normandy. And so the Allies were going across France, and by the time the investigation of this trial was underway, the trial itself didn't start till November. So you have the August lynching, then you have September and October to prepare. By then, the Allies were beginning to enter German territory, and they were not only finding the horrors of the Holocaust, but they were also finding the way that the Germans had treated U.S. and other Allied soldiers as POWs, and it was, in many cases, fairly badly. And we found cables that went back and forth between the White House and diplomats, or between the State Department and Italy and commanders, that were expressing essentially this concern. We can't allow the Germans to say, how dare you tell us how to treat your prisoners? Look what you did in Seattle. You know, you killed a guy. And the word went out in writing in many cases that we have to seek justice. We have to find justice here. And as it turns out, these black soldiers who were involved in the riot had very little constituency. They had very few people sticking up for them. Almost no one in this book is from the Seattle area. There are soldiers from around the country. And by the way, almost the largest share of them, not quite, but almost the largest share are from the Chicago area. And they were, if you will, they were a scapegoat in many cases. Now, that's one reason why. There was this larger pressure. I also think that two other things came into play. Leon Jaworski was a brilliant lawyer, and that was certainly proved out the rest of his career. Not only did he do Watergate, but he was president of the American Bar Association, Lyndon Johnson's private attorney. He was one of the key figures in the Warren Commission investigation of President Kennedy's death. He was just one of the best known lawyers of the 20th century. And there are writings of his that we found, writing to his family at home and to colleagues during this trial, that gives one the clear impression that he knew that this was going to really be a boost for his career, as it turned out to be, by the way. And one gets the picture of a lawyer who is really kind of eager to do virtually anything it took to get a conviction. And finally, when you really get down to the specifics, those were the broader pictures. There were many cases where the equally brilliant defense lawyer caught wind of what he realized the Army knew about this case. And I mean, literally, he saw papers sitting on Jaworski's desk. And in open court, he would challenge and say, "What is this? What do you have in front of you? Why on earth am I not getting these documents?" And Jaworski vehemently opposed any introduction of them because, of course, he knew that most of these things were really damaging to his case. And in many ways, it was the incompetence, in my view, and the inertia of the men who sat in judgment, the nine members of the court-martial, who were all white officers, all of them from the North, who refused to in any way rule in favor of the defense through numerous objections, numerous complaints about the way Jaworski was running his case. And as a matter of fact, the legal system that had been in place in the military ever since the beginning of our country, which was called the Articles of War, was under real assault for those kinds of abuses at that time. And we found documents in the presidential libraries that show that this was one of the cases that was influential in the final decision in 1950 to completely jettison the Articles of War and create the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which we now have. And one of the key things that that changed was that, for example, the court-martials were more likely to include in big cases a trial by your peers. So it was all of those things. It was political pressure. It was the ambition of Leon Jaworski, and it was the inertia of the men who were sitting in judgment who could have been more open to the defense's complaints.
Yeah. Do you think there was also pressure to get it done and over with?
Well, yes and no. I mean, it was the longest Army court-martial of World War II, and they didn't want it to be that way. So you're right. But here's how they did it. They met every day, 6 days a week. They met all day on Thanksgiving. It still took them 5 weeks to do this case. The two, all 43 defendants of these African-American enlisted men were assigned just two Army lawyers between them, two excellent Army lawyers, I might add, but they had to share them. Three of these men were on trial for their lives. All 43 faced a penalty that could have included life in prison. And yet those two lawyers, William Beeks and Howard Noyd, were given just 10 days to prepare their case, whereas Leon Jaworski had been working on it for 2 months. So when I asked that question of legal scholars and military scholars, how could that be, they also say that it was indicative of the times and in the time of war that the military expected its military justice system to move quickly and efficiently because to the extent that they could, if you will, acquit any of these men, they needed to get their warm bodies back onto the front lines. And that's actually what happened. Of the 43 men who were charged, 28 were convicted, and the 13 who were not were sent immediately overseas. So, yes, they wanted to get it over with. There was no sense, I think, that they wanted to dilly-dally. But the fact that it went so long and the fact that it took so many days is all part of this puzzle, which obviously intrigued me to say, you know, this was not an open-and-shut case, which it turned out not to be.
Yeah. You believe that the three defendants charged with murder did not kill Olivotto. What happened to those men? They were convicted?
Yes. Of the 43 who were charged, 28 were convicted. And there are 28 different stories of what happened to each of them and their sentences. They were not given uniform sentences. Depending on how many people fingered them or what certain evidence allegedly said or didn't say, the sentences ranged from one man getting only 6 months in jail to the alleged ringleader of this whole thing being given 25 years at hard labor initially. The three that were accused of murder, who were accused of being the ringleaders, were primarily assigned that designation by a couple of fellow black soldiers who were given immunity in return for their testimony. And one of those four who testified against them, his testimony, even at trial and reported in the media, lacked so much credibility that it was essentially disregarded. You know, it was clear what he was doing even then. He was simply trying to curry favor and save himself, and the judges never believed it. We were able to do much deeper digging about the remaining three. And the remaining three black soldiers who testified against these men and claimed that these three were ringleaders, each of them, as it turns out, had some sort of personal vendetta or motive against the three that they claimed were ringleaders. In the most extreme case, this one man was a gambler. He played craps and cards, and he owed a whole lot of money to some of these guys. And we believe saw it as an opportunity to get rid of those debts if these guys were put away. And in two other cases, we had individuals who had been disciplined by their fellow soldiers, who they then turned around and fingered. Of those three, none of them were executed. They weren't convicted of first-degree murder. Two were convicted of manslaughter. And then when I said 28 were convicted, all 28 were convicted of some level of rioting. You said what happened to them, that was their sentence. Some are still alive today.
Right.
Some died under natural circumstances. Some died under tragic circumstances. Some lived long lives. It's a whole variety of those things.
The men that survive, did you talk to them?
Yes. I had, it's funny how things work. One of my favorite authors is Marquez Garcia. The whole beauty of this book was that I started a lot of this thing when I was a much younger reporter, and then after having a whole lot of years in between, I was able to come back to this book when I sort of had a different perspective. And Gabriel Garcia Marquez, he had a book called Strange Pilgrims. And what it was when he was young and living in Europe, he had started any number of stories in his notebook and then sort of put those away and then becomes famous with Thousand Years of Solitude and all his other wonderful works. And after all of these years as a journalist and writer, he came back and he found those journals and he decided to finish the stories that he had started. He was sort of inspired as a young man and then was able to then turn around and kind of use the years of his experience. And in some ways, that's kind of what happened to me, because in 1986, I was able to meet a whole lot of people involved in this trial. They were still alive. I flew to Texas and met a whole bunch of the black defendants, many of whom since passed away. I met people who had witnessed the trial, who'd been in there, lawyers, all kinds of folks. And frankly, I didn't really know then what I had, but I did have the advantage of talking with them, meeting with them, interviewing them, getting it on tape, getting it in my notes. And so there are a lot of people that I've talked to over the years, many of whom are not still living. And in talking to them, something struck me again and again about the defendants. When I asked them flat out about the facts of the case, they would often, almost always, look me calmly and straight in the eye and say to me, we didn't do it. No extra explanation, here's me trying to prove it, just a very calm, we didn't do it. And of course, my answer then was, wait a minute, it's your word against the United States Army, and it was this long trial, and you were convicted, and, there's been no other evidence. And they said, well, you can say that, that's fine, but we didn't do it. And it haunted me. It haunted me, the sort of the calmness and the strength of that conviction. And even to this day, there are still three who are still alive, two who really have all their faculties. They're just wonderfully able to recall these things. And they do the same thing. They just very calmly say, but this is what it was like to be a black man in the 1940s. There were all sorts of injustices. And when they finally got through this, there were many other injustices that faced them. And there was a certain amount of steely resolve not to let that defeat them. But they always knew. They always knew that they didn't do it.
Is this case going to be reopened?
My wife and I were in the garden one day at our home here in Seattle, and the phone rang. And a member of Congress, Jim McDermott, was on the other end of the line. And he said, I just finished your book. I couldn't put it down. And he said, I'm thinking of bringing this to some of my colleagues in Congress. And I told him the name of the publisher. And on June 30th, first it was 24, now we're up to 30, I guess, my latest count that I know of. 30 members of Congress from throughout the United States, including Representative Jackson in Illinois and people from all over the states, have introduced a bill, I think it's 3174 in the House, that calls on the Secretary of the Army to, in essence, reopen this case now 60 years later. Technically, what they want them to do is see why it was that this case was never given the formal full review that was required of all capital cases back then. There was an appeal, but it was entirely bogus, frankly. Here we had thousands of pages of documents, and this Board of Appeal simply looked at all of this and in one sentence said, we have no grounds for overturning this, and everything is upheld. So Congress has, members of Congress have initiated this. They're, of course, seeking additional sponsors. It's been assigned to the House Armed Services Committee, and I don't know what subcommittee. It's just happened. And the hope is that they will do or at least consider what's happened twice before in U.S. history. In 1906 in Brownsville, Texas, there was an infamous incident in which any number of, literally hundreds of African-American soldiers who were part of the Buffalo Soldier groups had been moved to Brownsville and then falsely accused of rape and some other things and were summarily kicked out of the Army. And in 1969, I believe it was, President Nixon acknowledged that they were wrongly tried and convicted and kicked out and overturned their dishonorable discharges. There was only one left alive at that time. And then also in 1944, just like the Fort Lawton case, there was an infamous case in the San Francisco Bay Area at a place called Port Chicago, mm-hmm. even though it's nowhere near the city of Chicago. It's in San Francisco. And at that point, 50 African-American sailors were court-martialed for refusing to load ammunition ships because a week earlier an ammunition ship had blown up in the harbor, killing more than 300 sailors and civilians. President Clinton, decades later, did the same thing that Nixon had done in Brownsville. He'd said, you know, we're wrong on this, and we're going to overturn the dishonorable discharge that these men were given. In both of those two cases, by the way, there are memorials, one in Brownsville and one in Oakland, to those instances. And that suggestion has also been made on this case.
Yeah. Journalist Jack Hammond is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of On American Soil, How Justice Became a Casualty of World War II. This book tells the story of the largest Army court-martial of World War II, the largest and longest. It involved the lynching of an Italian POW in U.S. custody at Fort Lawton in Seattle, the year 1944. Three African-American soldiers were charged with murder, 40 others charged with rioting. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. The Port Chicago Mutiny and the munitions explosion of July 1944, if I'm getting my dates.
That's correct.
Correct.
Yeah.
Was also an interesting part of this story for me. July 18th, 320 men died. Most were African American. And I have to think that this had an impact on African American soldiers wherever they were.
You know, there is evidence that 1944, and particularly that summer, was a real critical time period for the African-American military experience. That event was one of several where African-American soldiers began to essentially assert themselves in a way that they just had not before then. I mean, these guys at Port Chicago, they called a mutiny, which is the legal naval term, but they basically said, enough, you know, I mean, we're just not going to put up with this anymore. You wouldn't have us loading these ships, we believe, if we were not black. You know, we're expendable in your mind. And there were other cases that were happening around the country where soldiers were saying no. There was a case where people in a fort in the state of Oregon, just below Seattle here, where white soldiers regularly used racially derogatory terms to describe African-American soldiers. And they stood up and said, finally, you know, at whatever penalty, no, we won't tolerate this anymore. And the press picked up on this, obviously, in some cases, saw it as some sort of threat. And interestingly, the black press, which was itself a fairly, a much more substantial, if you will, part of the American journalism scene than it is certainly now, was of at least two or three minds on this. There was a whole group that maybe you could call conservative who were chastising black soldiers who would speak up at this time, saying, listen, you know, you're not showing the rest of America your best side. We have to show that we're good cooperative citizens, and you're an embarrassment if you openly protest. And of course, there were others that were the real precursors to the civil rights movement who said, no, this is enough. It's about time. And they began demanding assignments that were more prestigious. They began demanding things that would help minimize the segregation. So the Port Chicago incident really was right in the middle of a very important time for blacks. But it also poisoned the story of the Fort Lawton incident, because the early, if you will, pop history of Fort Lawton was, oh, well, these guys were just, it was a black riot. That's what they called it, because there had been riots by black Americans in Detroit and L.A. and the Chicago area within the previous year. And historians sort of lumped this in there and said that there was this thing precipitated by blacks just being angry, when, of course, as I said earlier, it was simply two drunk soldiers who went at it. There was nothing racial about it. These were U.S. soldiers who thought they were being attacked by the enemy. And it could have been white, black, it could have been Italian, German, you name it.
Mm-hmm.
But that racial overtone was always very clearly part of this whole thing.
Yeah. Well, prior to the explosion of August 14th, 1944, what were relations like between the Italian POWs and the black soldiers stationed at Fort Lawton?
Well, this is another part of history that we think we've clarified, and that is that, again, had been reported in the media and elsewhere that there was tension, that black soldiers looked over and saw that for the most part, black soldiers throughout the United States were, when they were initially drafted into the Army or enlisted, were classified in the lowest intelligence classifications, which meant they were assigned the most menial work, loading and unloading ships, peeling potatoes, cleaning latrines. Those were almost exclusively black American jobs. Well, that's also what the Italians were assigned to do. I mean, they were obviously not out there doing anything other than the most menial work. And as the story went, black soldiers looked over and said, hey, how come they're doing that and we're doing this? And, you know, it's a plausible thing that in some situations and settings might have happened, but for the most part, it didn't and couldn't. And it's simply a matter of a timeline. When the Italian soldiers were first brought, these Italian prisoners were first brought to this fort in Seattle, it by coincidence happened to be the very day that those black soldiers went on field training exercises some 60 miles away. And for the next several weeks, the Italians settled in, and there were no black soldiers on the fort. When they returned from the field settings, within several days, they had their final inspections in preparation for getting a pass to go home for the 1 month, because they were about to go overseas. So weeks and weeks and weeks go by where the Italians are there and the black soldiers are not even on the base. When they finally are there at the very same time, it's for the black soldiers to get ready to go overseas. And so, frankly, there's no evidence, and none of the men who I've spoken with who were alive and part of this, that it was this simmering black resentment mm-hmm. of these Italians. The truth is, and the record shows clearly, that it was a small group but an important group of white soldiers who, for example, would disrupt when the Italians were singing in the PX, or when there was a lot of tension because a lot of white American girls who were civilians working on the base or who would have access to the base found the Italian soldiers to be very, very fun and enjoyable. They loved to dance and sing, and so they were frankly dating them. And that didn't happen just here. It happened all around the United States. And white soldiers, again, a small group but an important group, grew angrier and angrier about that, and we have plenty of evidence of that. And on the three nights leading up to this event on August 14th, three nights in a row, there were fistfights and other big conflicts between white soldiers and Italians. And even the local media, once the riot was finally reported and they came running around and looked for quotes and such, they initially reported that that was where the tension was between the whites and the Italians. But the media did not do a stellar job. This was not their finest hour, because by the time the trial came along, the reporting of this trial was incredibly docile. And now that we know what we know and what we've seen in the record, there was really just an astonishing acceptance of Jaworski's version of the case. It helped set the public opinion that, gee, they'd gotten the right guys.
Mm. Boy, the time is flying by, and there's so much in this story. Let me try and pick a couple of questions here that'll be good. Also, I think it's interesting to note that in the summer of 1944, some of that tension between the Italian prisoners of war and the white soldiers was due to the transition of Fort Lawton. The mission of the base was in transition because the way the war was progressing was changing. We're focusing now on Japan.
Right. The highest levels, long before most citizens realized it, the folks at the Pentagon realized that Germany was done. And there was a real high-level shift to say, okay, how are we going to now beat Japan as soon as Germany surrenders? The ports that were on the West Coast, Los Angeles, San Diego, San Francisco, Seattle, were being secretly prepared for what they assumed would be an invasion of Japan. And if we're doing our time right, remember that the atomic bombs were not dropped until August of 1945, a full year later. So in August of 1944, this giant Fort Lawton, which had been pretty much a training center and had all sorts of other responsibilities, was secretly being prepared to be this giant triage center for what we assumed would be tens of thousands of U.S. casualties, injuries and death. And what they were going to do was essentially completely change the mission of this so that as we thought all of these wounded soldiers would be coming back across the Pacific, they would first come to Seattle for treatment and then be distributed elsewhere. And that really plays into this whole story because the command who were assigned to Fort Lawton, we now know, when we look at all of what happened, and including what happened to them after this case, they were woefully unprepared for this. They were utterly overwhelmed. And a lot of the decisions that they made day-to-day about the treatment of their black soldiers, about the treatment of their prisoners of war, at the time and in retrospect, end up being major contributors to both the riot and the hanging that occurred, and to the general misunderstanding afterwards. And I can say that with confidence because, as it turns out, never made public until our book, the Army, because of the incompetence of the commander of Fort Lawton and the way things were handled relative to this riot and this hanging, they dismissed the fort commander. They pulled him off of his command. That was never reported to the public, to the media, or anyone else. And it was not revealed to the defense. Imagine how powerful that could have been. Further, they dismissed several other key people, either that or they prepared to dismiss them, I should say, who the Army quietly and secretly knew had really dropped the ball on all this. But here's the kicker. Those folks, for the most part, not the commander of the fort, but the others that were eventually going to be reassigned or even court-martialed, they were allowed to testify against these black soldiers. The defense was never told that the Army knew that they had made all these errors. And the guy who I think killed Olivotto was also one of those who ended up testifying against the black soldiers. And days, literally days after they were convicted, the Army then went ahead and court-martialed him on essentially a technicality, and he was out of the Army within a couple of weeks. The guy had been in there for 4 years, and then boom, they got rid of him.
Yeah.
So the mission of the fort changing like that was really part of the problem in the war, was that they just did not have the best and brightest command at this very critical fort here during World War II. And, some of this has resonance, I think, with some of the complaints that have been issued today about what happened at Abu Ghraib or elsewhere. And, you know, the initial instinct was to blame just the enlisted men and to sort of overlook, well, who was in charge and you know, what was going on there. Well, very similarly, that's what happened then, is that the enlisted men were the ones that got all the publicity, all the negative consequences, everything else. But frankly, there were a few in the Army who realized that that didn't really happen unless the command had failed.
Yeah. One last question. Leon Jaworski, celebrated career. He wrote his memoir. He wrote other books. Did he ever look back on this publicly?
This is a conspicuously absent from his any number of memoirs that he's prepared. And I think now that we know what we know why.
Hmm.
This is a guy who, first of all, was utterly brilliant. There's no getting around it. But he loved to talk about himself, and he loved to talk about his many significant accomplishments. He wrote about them. And virtually every part of his own career, he documented publicly. And so here he was, the prosecutor in the largest and longest Army court-martial of the entire war, the prosecution of which helped give him a springboard to what would become... He was actually the first one ever to prosecute a case under the Geneva Convention. That was his next assignment after this. And yet, in all of his books, he utterly ignores this, save for one paragraph in one book where he actually gets the facts wrong. This Italian was killed by being lynched on an obstacle course at the base of a bluff in the fort. He summarily said, after prosecuting a case at Fort Lawton, where an Italian was found lynched in a barracks, and then he just simply moves on from there. And, you know, I'm not the biographer of Leon Jaworski, but one would, I think, have to stop and say, well, gee, maybe this makes sense. Maybe Leon did know how badly this case was found, because why not trumpet this big victory, if you will?
Mm.
That's certainly consistent with what we've discovered.
Yeah. A question we'll probably never be able to answer. Did it haunt him?
Well, you know, he was the kind of guy who always seemed to turn around and take advantage of the next opportunity. And his life story still needs to be told. I mean, if there's a listener out there who's looking for a great project, I think what happened was he was one of those, if you will, revered figures of the generation that I belong to, who were reared on Watergate.
Mm-hmm.
And this whole notion of challenging government figures, somehow he became immune to that, because in that character list of Watergate, of course, Leon Jaworski had to be one of the good guys. And so people in my generation who came up with Watergate maybe never thought to look and say, well, what is the story? Because frankly, again, all of his history has almost been written just by him. And that's sort of the danger, I guess, all along the line, you know, of... making sure that everybody gets the close look. I don't think he's a bad guy. I don't think Leon Jaworski, you know, his career was like some terrible person. But
no.
In this particular case, I don't think you can come to any other conclusion in that his behavior in some cases was unethical. And that's just not my belief. I've certainly asked that and documented in the book other people who have suggested that was the case here.
Yeah. We've got to go. We've strayed past our time. Jack Hammond, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you, Celeste. I've enjoyed it.
Jack is the author of On American Soil, How Justice Became a Casualty of World War II, the publisher, Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill.
And that was an interview that Celeste conducted from back on July 20th. This is the Afternoon Magazine. It's 5 minutes before 2 o'clock. Settlement prices are in from the Board of Trade. Here is Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Tom, from the Chicago Board of Trade on this report day. And we'll take a complete look at those numbers, by the way, during the closing market report this afternoon. We'll have a conversation I held with Daryl Good a bit earlier today about price forecasting and what he thinks farmers ought to be doing with their corn and soybeans at this time, given the report that was released this morning. And Mike Zuzulo will be along to talk about the markets, as he is every Friday during the closing market report. Now, the numbers from the Chicago Board of Trade ended like this today. September wheat was down a nickel, the high price at $3.32, the low at $3.19. A quarter. Settlement price there at 321 and a quarter. Once again, the SEP's off 5 cents. December contract 344 and three quarters, the high, the low at 333 and a half. Settlement price at 335 and three quarters. They were down 6 3/4. And the March contract in the wheat pit, 356 and three quarters, the high. low at 346.5, and the settlement price at 348.5, down 7. May futures down 6.5, 361.5 the high, the low at 354. Settlement price there at $3.55, down 6.5 cents, in July at 365, high, low at 355.5. And a settlement price at 357, down 6.25. The beans on my mind just simply because Dave Dickey handed me the weekly changes, and they were down 21 cents in the November, something we definitely need to talk about with Mike Zuzolo this afternoon. September corn, 223, the high, the low at 217.5. Settlement price at 217.75, down 7.25. December futures into corn pit, 236, the high, the low at 30. Settlement price at $2.31 a bushel for the December corn. They were off 7.25 today. March futures were off 7.5. They settled at 39.75 with a high of $2.45, a low at 239.25. May soybeans, or rather May corn. Boy, I can't get the beans out of my mind. May corn, 251, the high, the low at 244.75. Settlement price at 245.5. They were down 6.75. And the July futures, 254.25, the high, the low at 49.5. Settlement price there at $2.49. They were down 6. September futures down 2. 252, the settlement price, the high at 55, the low at 51.5 for next year's September corn. Oats finished at 153.75, down 7.25 for the SEPs. December off 5.75 at 163 for the day. Now the soy complex, beans, 654, the high, the low at 634. Settlement price for the soybeans at 643 in the August contract. They were up 2. September's were down 2.75, 55 the high, the low at 38, and a settlement price at $6.40.5. You know, November new crop soybeans, $6.62.5 the high, the low at 644.25. Settlement price there at 648. They were down 2.25 on the day. January futures, 667.5 the high, the low at 650. Settlement price 653 for the Jans and a quarter. They were down 1.5 in the March contract, 666.5 the high, the low at 650. Settlement price at 654.25, down 1.25. May futures were off 0.75. Their settlement price at 650.5 today. August bean meal, 203. The settlement price down $4.60. The September at 202.20. They were down 260. August bean oil, 22.80. Settlement price there up 13 in the September's, up 5 at 22.73. Now here's Tom Rogers with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
All right, quick look at the Merc. The August feeder cattle had a high today, 109.90, the low 109.10, settled at 109.27.5, down 50 on the day. September, the high 107.70, the low 106.55, settled 106.62.5, down 115. And October feeders, the high 106.85, the low 105.60, settled at 105.72.5, down 115. August live cattle had a high today of 79.70, the low 78.70, settled at 79.07.5, down 120. October, the high 80.50, the low 79.57.5, settled at 80.07.5, down 105. Over to the hogs, August, the high today 69.50, the low 69.20, settled at 69.40, up 22.5. October lean hogs, 58.85, the high, the low 58.22.5.